Hey, JR, just say hi. I'm glad that I'm able to join you.
Yeah. Good to have you here.
Yes. Welcome, sir.
All right. So let's go ahead. We'll call the meeting to order. And I'd like to start. I'll hand it over to Chuck Brown, who's going to walk us through some of the meeting logistics for today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, members of the public watching through the streaming or online. And everyone else that has joined, a couple of items to just cover. Public comments can be submitted via the public comment form that's available through a link on the agenda on the ITAC meeting site, which can be found at asset.az.gov. For presenters, please, when you present to the committee, make sure you introduce yourself before you begin speaking. Speak loudly and clearly, and as you transition from one speaker to the other on the same item, please make sure you identify yourself. Committee members, as you are making motions or seconding motions, please make sure you identify yourself before you make the motion or make the second so that we can record it, so that everybody's aware this meeting is being recorded to create the public record going forward. Mr. Chairman, anything else you would like me to cover that I may not have?
I think that's it, Chuck. I'll tell you what, one more thing that we will cover is that this meeting now going forward, because we are recording it, the recording will be our official record of the minutes. And so we will no longer do written summary minutes. The meeting recording itself will be our official record. So with that, I'll remind the public, if you have comments that you'd like to submit, Chuck has provided instructions on how to find that link. You can submit your comments during that link, and as appropriate, those will be brought forward as you submit them, and we'll review them for response. We will address our first item on the agenda, which is our approval of the March minutes. The March meeting also was a recording, so that recording is our record of the minutes. And I want to go ahead and call that to attention. We really won't probably have edits to our minutes going forward, but I will go ahead and open it up for any questions from the committee members on that, and we will accept a motion with regard to the minutes.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
to entertain that motion, can we complete the roll call, sir?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, I did miss that. Shay, would you go ahead and do that?
Thank you so much. I have taken roll by the entries, but if you would like, I can call out everyone.
Yes, please go ahead and do that.
Yes, I will. J.R. Sloan.
Here.
Representative Jeff Winninger. Senator Rick Gray. Brian Kirkland.
Present.
Exactly. David Byers.
Here.
Thank you. Eddie Cook.
Here.
Thank you. Keith Sherratt. Gilbert Arantxa.
I'm here.
Yes, thank you. Lev Gornick.
Lev Gornick here.
Gornick, thank you. Jaggy.
Here.
Thank you. Michael Dobb.
Here.
Great. Tim Romer.
I'm here.
Great. Richard Stevnick.
Rebecca Pereira here for Richard.
Thank you, Rebecca. All right, Mr. Chairman, we do have a quorum.
All right, very good. Thank you. Okay, so back to the minutes. We'll accept a motion with regard to our March meeting minutes.
This is Gil Arantxa. I'll move to approve the minutes.
Thank you, Gil.
Dave Byers, second.
Thank you, David. Okay, committee members, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, thank you very much. With that, we will move on to our first item of business on the agenda, which is the Department of Economic Security. that we'll be talking about the DDD HIPAA transaction code set.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Sudhi Syed. I'm an engagement manager with Department of Administration. I am joined here by members of the Department of Economic Security Project Team. I will let the individuals introduce themselves, after which I will give a brief overview of this project.
Hi, this is Durga Patila. I'm the Chief Technology Officer for Department of Economic Security.
Hello, I'm Laura Wright, the IT Administrator for the Division of Developmental Disabilities, and I am here at the meeting in place for Zane Garcia Ramadan, our interim assistant director.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the Division of Developmental Disabilities, DDD, receives Medicaid funding through a contract with Access to provide services to citizens determined eligible for DDD services. The HIPAA transaction code set project investment justification requests approval to implement a new software that provides additional features and controls to ensure the claims processing procedure is in compliance with the Access contract and federal rules. At this time, I will turn this over to the project team to present additional information regarding this pitch and answer any questions you may have.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This is Laura Wright, and I'll be reviewing the DDD HIPAA TCS project presentation with you. I don't see the slide presentation. There we go. Thank you. Next slide, please. The reason for this project request is on January 7th of 2019, the division received a notice from our major funder, Access, indicating that DDD was not in compliance with its contract, specifically related to the claims and payment processing. This notice to cure contract action noted primarily the failure to meet federal requirements for Medicaid billing and payments, specifically to utilize standardized billing codes, which are HCPCS, use of standard claim forms, and adherence to the National Correct Coding Initiative. Next slide, please. The benefit of this project to the division, most notably, is the resolution of the contract action notice to cure with Access. The division will become compliant with CMS Medicaid billing rules. Additionally, the software will be configurable by the division should it be necessary in the future. Next slide, please. Significant planning work was completed prior to DDD engaging in this procurement process, primarily alongside an IT consulting firm, Barry Dunn, who helped DDD analyze our current claims processing system and determine how we could most quickly and effectively come into compliance with national standards, while also taking into account the very complicated process DDD has built over the last 30 years using non-standard codes and the way that they interface with DDD's current system named Focus, which contains more than 20 interrelated applications. One of the final reports that Barry Dunn completed included research of 9 prominent vendors they believed could meet DDD's needs. There were only 4 of those vendors that met every item on the requirement list. The selected vendor for this project was one of those 4. This solicitation was open for 40 days. Only one vendor responded to the solicitation, and that was WellSky. Additionally, the dollar amount of this procurement aligns well within the cost range estimate that the IT consulting firm provided to DDD. Next slide, please. As I mentioned, the vendor selected is WellSky. This will be a commercial off-the-shelf product with configuration. It will be hosted in a Microsoft Azure commercial cloud, which is FedRAMP certified as required. And the solution will be integrated with DDD's existing system called Focus. Next slide, please. This shows the high-level responsibilities for both DDD and the vendor. DDD's major responsibilities will include contract oversight, providing subject matter experts, user acceptance testing, review and acceptance of milestones and deliverables, as well as data cleansing for the data migration. We'll share the following responsibilities with the vendor: project planning, project monitoring, system integration, data migration, and training, which will primarily utilize a train-the-trainer model. The vendor will be primarily responsible for the following: implementation of the software solution, the initial configuration of the software, cloud hosting of this solution, application testing, disaster recovery, and ongoing maintenance. Next slide, please. There will be oversight for this project by both DES and DDD's executive leadership team. And the remainder of the slide shows how DDD and DTS will work cooperatively to lead all aspects of this project. Next slide, please. This is a high-level projected project schedule, and this is based on WellSky being able to begin by mid-June of this year. We've highlighted here the major project areas, including design and integration, configuration and data conversion, testing, training, and deployment, which now is expected in May of next year. Next slide, please. Here we have our project costs. This shows the expected costs over the next 5 years, broken down by development versus operational costs. We anticipate our first expenditure to occur in fiscal year 2021. The first year's development costs mostly with minimal licensing, maintenance, and hosting fees. And as you see, the remaining years all include all licensing, maintenance, and hosting fees. You may notice for the licensing, maintenance, and hosting fees that they reduce in years 4 and 5, as the need for enhanced support services from the vendor are projected to decrease in these years. Enhanced support services include such items as configuration, optimization, custom reports, and ongoing training needs. Next slide, please. Here's our financial impact. You will notice that DDD is not requesting a new appropriation and will use current resources to fund this project. The majority of the funding will come from our capitation, which is known as the ALTEX funding stream, and that's shown on the other appropriated line. And these are the total costs for the next 5 years. Next slide, please. Success for this project will require more than just development and implementation of software. Our plan also highlights communication activities for both internal and external partners, training for both internal and external partners, in addition to all the required development activities. Some major indicators of success of this project include the software is implemented in a timely manner, DDD is in compliance with CMS Medicaid billing rules, and DDD satisfies the notice to cure from Access. Next slide, please. Therefore, DES-DDD is requesting approval to offer a contract to WellSky to purchase their cloud-hosted claims and payment software. This will allow the division to come into compliance with our Access contract, satisfy the notice to cure contract action, and have a claims process that meets federal requirements for medical billing. Next slide, please. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for your time. At this time, Durga and I would like to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Laura. With that, I'll turn it over to the committee members for questions. Just as a reminder, please do introduce yourself as you ask your question.
Dave Byers, how many users are on the system? So I assume your licensing costs are related to the number of licenses or users. You got about $1 million a year. How many users are there?
There will be all of our contracted vendors as well as all of our claim staff, which I don't remember the exact number, but I believe it will be around 800 or slightly more than that.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Okay. With that, I'll turn it back over to you, Sudhi.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, ASSET is recommending that the pitch be approved with the following conditions. Should development costs exceed the approved estimates by 10% or more, or should there be significant changes to the proposed technology, scope of work, or implementation schedule, the agency must amend the pitch to reflect the changes and submit to ADOA ASSET.
Okay, committee members, any questions on those conditions? Okay, hearing none, I will accept a motion with regard to the project.
Hi, this is Eddie. I move to approve.
Thank you, Eddie. Do we have a second?
Lev Gonick, happy to second.
All right, thank you, Lev. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Laura and Doria, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, we'll move to the next item on our agenda, which is also Department of Economic Security. This is the DERS group bringing forward the pandemic unemployment assistance application.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Sudhi Syed. I'm an engagement manager with the Department of Administration. I am joined here by members of Department of Economic Security project team. I will let the individual introduce themselves, after which I will give a brief overview of this action item.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Michael Weishart, the Assistant Director for the Division of Employment and Rehabilitation Services at DES.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Buckley. I'm the Deputy Chief Information Officer for DES.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is Christopher Goins, Project Manager with the Division of Employment and Rehabilitation Services.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the Division of Employment and Rehabilitation Services received approval from ASSET on April 14th for the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Project. The goal of this project is to comply with the U.S. Department of Labor's CARES Act 2020 and provide pandemic unemployment assistance to recipients due to the current COVID-19 crisis. At the time of approval, the expected duration and cost of the software licensing and cloud hosting were undetermined. Since approval, ASSET and DES have partnered together to address these unknowns. The DES project team has joined us today to modify the original pitch to extend the project's end date and capture the newly established software licensing and cloud hosting costs. At this time, I will turn this over to the project team to present additional information regarding this change request and answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, really appreciate you all taking the time today to have this important conversation for the citizens of Arizona. Moving on to the next slide. The pandemic unemployment program, I don't know who's controlling the presentation, but there we go. The pandemic unemployment assistance program is part of the unemployment insurance piece of the CARES Act that was passed in March to respond to the ongoing pandemic. This program didn't exist previous to the CARES Act being passed, and is a program that is benefiting individuals that are not traditionally eligible for unemployment insurance benefits. So we have a historic legacy unemployment insurance system and protocol that we've been using for many, many years in Arizona. The pandemic unemployment program was set up outside of that scope. Many states have had disasters in their history. So Texas, as an example, Katrina, Rita, many issues that they faced. So they had a disaster unemployment protocol. Arizona has been blessed with not having major disasters previously. So we didn't have a disaster unemployment system available to fall back on. So we had to stand something up brand new. And so this is certainly an unprecedented request, but these are unprecedented time. So more than a quarter million Arizonans are going to leverage this system. We are going to be paying out somewhere between $175 million and $200 million in benefits per week out of this system going forward. You know, significant progress has been made in making this a four Arizonans. Moving forward, can we go on to the next slide? So APIDGE was approved early on as we recognized that we needed to stand this up as a state to get these benefits out to Arizonans. The initial piece of the solution where we took applications from citizens went live the night of May 12th on schedule, a few hours later than we wanted, but certainly on the date that we had indicated to the public that it was going to be available. The PIP was previously approved. We have since moved forward with implementing further functionality in the system. So now folks, not only do we take applications, folks can process their weekly certifications and we can make benefit payments out of the system. In the first 2 days, we went live with those pieces on May 17th. In the first 2 days of operation, we paid out over $125 million in benefits to citizens of Arizona. So the system is working well. There's obviously kinks and bumps, but overall, it is, you know, standing up a brand new system to meet a brand new program's needs in a 3 week time period is definitely a huge challenge and has had some issues, but we continue to overcome them so we can move forward meeting the needs of Arizonans. It is estimated that we'll need this system operational for the pandemic unemployment for 10 months. And so that is how it is priced out, and you'll see that later on in the presentation. We continue to work with the vendor on hosting costs and options and you know, any of the other issues that we run into as we move forward with this. Next slide. So I'm going to turn it over to Chris and Chuck to walk through the technical aspects of the project. But again, really appreciate everyone's insight as we continue to think through the best way to get services and financial resources to Arizonans as quickly and appropriately as possible.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is Chris Goins, the project manager for the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance System. When we were presented with the need to stand up a solution to support the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, several options were investigated. We engaged a number of states and talked to a number of individuals at the federal level to get an idea of what we might be up against. Geographic Solutions presented a totally standalone system that would enable us to make payments without needing to modify the existing system, which, as Mr. Weishart talked to earlier, that is a 30-plus-year-old mainframe system that is inflexible in its design and how it processes unemployment insurance claims. The standalone application that we stood up can perform the intake functionality as well as facilitating the processing of all of the claim functionality and payment to individuals. The standalone system had been previously implemented with two other states. It's entirely customizable for individual states' needs, and having the functionality already built provided us with the ability to get the functionality out to the public as quickly as possible with minimal impact to staff. Next slide, please. So the technology that was provided to us is it's a software as a service subscription PUA application, pandemic unemployment application.
that allows us to perform eligibility determinations, process payments. It is currently hosted in the Geographic Solutions Data Center. Again, it's easily configurable and integrated. Personally identifiable information, federal tax information, personal health information, data resides in a SOC 2 and SOC 3 certified environment. We are currently pursuing AZ RAMP certification with Geographic Solutions. And the system that Geographic Solutions has is a subset of a larger integrated workforce and unemployment insurance system. So there's potential use of that with what we have today. Next slide, please. The project responsibilities for our agency included project management, guiding the customization through engagement of subject matter experts, interface specifications so that we can communicate with our partners effectively, validating system functionality, user acceptance testing, and training. The shared functionality that we had with the vendor was functional requirements decomposition to ensure that our system functionality was appropriate for Arizona, meeting the requirements design and having those meetings to establish our requirements, test case creation, and they assisted with data conversion. And the vendor's sole responsibilities were installation of software, customization, design documentation, interface development, train the trainer, implementation, and their data center environment creation. Next slide, please. Our project structure was divided into the agency and the vendor with the agency guiding policy, business and systems analysis, overall operations, training, server operation and interfaces. And the vendor's project manager was responsible for business analysis, their technical teams, testing, interfaces, deployment, and training our staff. Next slide, please. So our project timeline was obviously very short. Michael indicated it was a project timeline of 3 weeks. We began activities on April 22nd, and we went live on May 12th. This compressed timeline is unprecedented in the unemployment insurance world, and we were able to roll this application out for the public in a matter of about 3.5 weeks with the vendor's incredible support. Next slide, please. So our project costs for the initial purchase of the software as a service application is listed in the fiscal year 20 category with software license and maintenance fees for the remainder of fiscal year 20 also listed. The total development costs and the combined total for the remainder of the application's usage are also listed. The hosting is unknown right now. We had somewhat of a last minute hosting costs with Geographic Solutions, and those are to be determined. Next slide, please. So the financial impact of this application, support for this application and these funds are completely federally funded. We did pursue federal funds available to us from the Department of Labor, and those funds are being used to pay for the pandemic unemployment assistance system. Next slide, please. So our success is really in the realm of change management, reducing the amount of changes that we needed to make to the system enable us to roll it out to the public. Our measures of success are being realized as we sit here talking today. Folks in Arizona are receiving pandemic unemployment assistance. There was over 110,000 applications for pandemic unemployment assistance since we've gone live. Payments are being made timely. They are inclusive of the $600 additional federal pandemic unemployment compensation, and are continuing to strive with the vendor to ensure program integrity is maintained while we use their system in concert with our existing legacy system. Next slide, please. So we are requesting approval to obviously continue our licensing and maintenance costs, and also as we pursue the data center hosting costs for the next 10 months of this application. At this moment, it is estimated that the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program will last through the end of the year, but that could be extended by an act of Congress if it's deemed necessary. Next slide, please.
All right, thank you, Chris. I'll open up to the committee members with any questions that you have. A reminder to introduce yourself as you ask your question.
Well, this is Brian Kirkland. Question for you on the licensing and the terms. You mentioned at one point that this vendor also offers a solution that could potentially play a role in the long-term plans around unemployment system or legacy system. Can you talk a little bit about that, and if this is that stepping stone, and if any thoughts have been done there, or if this is really just a independent thing that doesn't bias anything on that long-term strategy?
Mr. Chair, Brian, I'll jump in. So one of the considerations, obviously, when we selected this particular vendor and solution was their track record and the sort of module way that they built out systems in other states. So it was absolutely a consideration about the opportunity for scalability that might exist from leveraging this. I think the big thing for us right now is we know we need to modernize the entire UI platform, and we're going to be working with you guys to help navigate the best possible path for Arizona. We had a tremendous amount of learning in a really short period of time standing up this pandemic unemployment system protocol, and we will be leveraging that to figure out the best path, which may or may not include this vendor, but certainly would be a consideration as we move toward a full-blown RFP for unemployment insurance modernization in hopefully the reasonably near future.
Mr. Chairman, this is Chuck Buckley. I'd like to add that while it is a potential path forward to expand the use of the Geographic Solutions PUAS system, that the state and the Department of Economic Security still retains ownership of all data within that system. So should the decision be made to move in a different direction, we can reclaim and export that data back into DES systems to be migrated into whatever the updated unemployment system is in the end.
Okay.
Hi, this is Lev Gonick. Thank you for the presentation. Two questions. One, is the current application supporting integration from other systems related to fields and or audit reconciliations against fields that are entered by users? And the second piece is a follow-up to the question that was just posed. In the go-forward scenario, do we anticipate actually leveraging federal dollars in order to actually modernize the application and its, and I presume, related integration into other systems for UI?
Mr. Chair and members, I'll leave it to the technical experts on the first question relative to how those fields work interrelatedly, but to the second question around leveraging funding, it would be our expectation that we would be able to use the funding that is provided to respond to the pandemic to move forward with modernization of the legacy system. So it would not be my expectation to need to request additional funding from the state in order to modernize as we continue to think through what the best path is and leverage all of the systems that we currently have in place.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is Chris Goins again to answer the question about the data fields and interconnectivity between our existing system. We are doing checks against our existing system to ensure that data integrity is being maintained and that we are cross-checking to make sure that folks are not filing in both systems. Obviously, right now, that's a very manual process, and we're working toward automating that to alleviate the stress that that puts on staff.
Okay, Lev, did that address your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? I have one on the financials. Given that the hosting costs are unknown at this point, is it the expectation and or assumption that the federal funding will be expanded to cover whatever the hosting costs are?
Mr. Chairman, yes. We're already in contact with our federal partners on their contribution to those costs. So it is our expectation that those costs will be covered by the federal funds associated with the pandemic unemployment program.
Okay. And then this is a question that sort of actually it's kind of blended. It may go to, it's part of it's going to go to DES staff. Part of it may go to the oversight staff. In terms of the expectation of what, do we have enough information from GSI to have an expectation around whether that those hosting costs will be greater than 10%, which would be our standard provision, such that would drive a need to return to this committee?
Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, we continue to work with the vendor, and it's a multi-tiered vendor because of leveraging the state contract to be able to access GSI's work. We're continuing to connect with them on what the ongoing hosting costs are going to look like. I think it is entirely reasonable for us to return to meet with the ITEC committee in June to discuss what the outcome of those conversations are because we're working through a fluid situation with the vendor, that their contracted entity, SHI, as well as Microsoft and the Azure piece of it. I think that there's additional information that can be brought to this committee to help fully inform everyone on exactly what the implications of this particular project are for Arizona.
Very good. Okay, thank you. All right, any other questions from the committee?
This is Dave Byers. Don't they have an estimate so you could put an estimate in so then if it didn't deviate by 10%? And I'm not sure I see the purpose of coming back when the feds are going to pay the cost and it's going to be after the fact, so we have to approve it anyway. It seems like a meaningless exercise. Well, I just wonder, don't they have an estimate of the cost? So you said it's, you know, X number of dollars. And then if it deviated from that by 10%, you'd have to come back perhaps.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Byers, we don't have numbers yet from the vendor as we continue to work through all of the pieces and how quickly things are happening. But happy to provide in writing what those numbers look like for reaction and, you know, however – the committee and the chairman wants to proceed is perfectly fine with us as far as what information we provide around this going forward.
Okay. Is it worth discussing, you know, I believe the original, you know, the original plan was for this application to be hosted within DES's Azure environment. And is that also a future consideration that you're going to be looking at over this next time period, where it could be that you're coming back with GSI long-term hosting costs versus, you know, Azure hosting costs?
Mr. Chairman, board, this is Chuck Buckley, sorry. So during the initial rollout on May 12th, quality assurance testing within our Azure environment identified some discrepancies in system performance from the GSI data center where it's developed to the Azure hosted environment. So thus the decision to move it into the GSI data center where performance would be extremely similar given the same configuration of equipment. Given the rapid pace of the deployment, given the rapid pace of system improvement so far, and, you know, they rolled out version 2, if you will, a week later, and they're continuing work on deployment, it is reasonable to expect that the system will remain to be hosted within GSI's data center.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, just to add a little bit to that, GSI currently hosts workforce solutions and UI solutions for more than 25 states in the country. So it is not an abnormal situation for them to be hosting a system of this magnitude. So that given that it's working well and we have so many moving pieces on the technology side relative to unemployment insurance, Chuck's description of, I think, the go forward plan at the moment is accurate.
Okay, I'm going to ask our oversight folks, since I know you're aware of some of the circumstances, I'll ask Chuck Brown, do you have any guidance or how have you contemplated this for the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as we worked through the initial project investment justification form, we understood there were environmental costs. We had an idea of what those were. We do realize that the plan has changed. So from oversight's perspective, the cleanest way to proceed it would be with an approval of the system based on those understood costs. We have the standard condition that we plan to add into this, which would have the 10% barrier. If we stay within those parameters, then we can provide a June informational consent agenda update just to let the committee know how it turned out. If we go outside of those parameters, we would bring it forward as a change request to make sure we fully explain what the expenditures were and the outcome of where we're at.
Okay, thank you. David, does that sound reasonable to you?
that seems fine. Another question, though. The presentation and the scope was for 10 months, but if Congress extends it, do you want the motion to be to allow it to continue if the costs stay the same, or do you want to make them come back a third time? If they have to extend past 10 months. I normally wouldn't care very much. It just seems, though, like you guys did an extraordinary job of getting this up and running.
Right.
It's kind of an unusual deal. It's coming to us after the fact. And if Congress extends it, we're going to have to approve it. So I just want to know what motion do you want, to end the 10 months or allow it to continue?
So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as far as the project goes, as long as the development is completed, and we have moved into the M&O process, and we don't do any future development, most likely the project would be closed and we wouldn't have to have the committee extend the project at all. If parameters change and they need to do some type of high-level development to meet new parameters from Congress, then there's the possibility we could be seeking another change request. But as it stands right now, I don't believe we would have to come back unless we got significant development requirement changes.
Okay, good. All right. Well, that addresses the third visit. We may not be able to avoid the second. So, any other questions from the committee? Okay, hearing none, Sudhi, back over to you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, ASTAT is recommending that the change request be approved with the following conditions. Condition one. Should development costs exceed the approved estimates by 10% or more, or should there be significant changes to the proposed technology, scope of work, or implementation schedule, the agency must amend the pitch to reflect the changes and submit to ADOA ASTAT. Condition 2. DES shall work with ADOA asset security team to ensure that appropriate security controls are in place to protect state data.
Okay, any questions on those conditions or comments? Okay, with that, I will entertain a motion with regard to the project.
Mr. Chairman, this is Tim Romer. I'll make a motion to approve.
Thank you, Tim. Do we have a second?
This is Mike Dobb.
I'm going to give it to Mike Dobb. You popped up first. Jeggy, hang on. We'll get you one yet. All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay. Any opposed? All right. That motion carries. Thank you very much, Mike, Chuck, and Chris. With that, we'll move on to the next item on our agenda, which is the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, bringing forward their electronic visit verification system project.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Sudhi Syed. I'm an engagement manager with the Department of Administration. I am joined here by members of Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System project team. I will let the individuals introduce themselves, after which I will give a brief overview of this action item.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dara Johnson, and I'm a Program Development Officer for Access.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is Dan Lippert. I am the Assistant Director for Information Services with Access.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is Jeff Teagan. I'm the Assistant Director for the Division of Business and Finance at Access.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tishana Douglas, and I am the project manager for the EVV program at Access.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, on May 15, 2019, the electronic visit verification system project was approved with conditions by ITAC committee. The goal of this project is to implement an electronic visit verification system for in-home services. Implementation of this system will help to ensure that billed services were rendered to reduce waste and fraud. The Access project team has joined us today to request approval to extend the project's end date, cost, and scope. At this time, I will turn this over to the project team to present additional information regarding this change request and answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dara Johnson, and today we will go over a few items to note here, including a project overview since it has been a year since we've been before you, talk a little bit about our project structure, some challenges that we exhibited and how we address those challenges, a new proposed timeline, an overview of our certification roadmap or the certification process required by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, a highlight of our financials, and an overview of the change request summary before you today. Next slide, please. Since we were before you over a year ago, we thought it would be helpful to highlight exactly what electronic visit verification is. It is a federal mandate. We also call it EVV for short. And Access has decided to implement both the personal care and the home health services mandate of simultaneously or at the same time. In its most basic form, EVV is an electronic timesheet for individuals that go into a member's home or meet a member in the community to provide services. EVV is required for both personal care, which is an individual assisting someone with bathing or eating or with maintaining their home, and also for home health services, which require a nurse to provide services such as wound care. The system must independently verify the type of service performed, the individual receiving and providing the service, both the date and time the service begins and ends, and the location of the service. Access has chosen an open vendor model for this program. That means that Access is procured for a statewide vendor, otherwise known as SanData, to provide the service statewide,
We are also allowing flexibility for a provider community to choose a preferred provider of their own. We are using this federal mandate to leverage an opportunity for us to create and fund other system efficiencies, such as monitoring access to care, reducing provider burden, and preventing fraud, waste, and abuse. Next slide, please. This is an overview of our project structure. Access has partnered with the state of Hawaii for this project since we support the data processing for their Medicaid program. Both Arizona and Hawaii have fully dedicated project teams to support successful completion of the project, including both a project manager and utilizing the internal subject matter expertise, as well as considerable input and participation from the managed care organizations or our health plans, as well as our provider community. And the project management is also supported by various work streams that are facilitated and supported by our project management team, as well as led by our vendor Sandata, which includes work streams around testing, support, outreach and training, and certification. And I will defer to my colleague, Dan Lippert, to discuss our relationship with Hawaii when it comes to the data processing system.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the state of Arizona has been under contract for about the last 20 years to administer the Medicaid Management Information System for the state of Hawaii. Essentially, that is the system that processes claims, encounters, provider, that sort of thing. It's really what runs a Medicaid organization. So if you notice the difference between the two project structures, you only see one area where there's a systems manager, system development, and system testing. Those are the functions that Arizona performs for the state of Hawaii. So we are performing those services for both states. This offers us a great amount of flexibility and partnership and therefore cost savings by working with another state.
Thank you. Next slide. I wanted to discuss the challenges that were exhibited during our development of this project. We did experience challenges, and initially most of those challenges related to planning. We wanted to take additional time for planning to ensure that our program was responsive to the needs of our stakeholders, as well as meeting our obligations under the federal mandate. And most recently, our project has exhibited delays in relation to the agency's response to the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as the response of our provider network. One of the initial challenges were business rules. Although we had delays with the business rules, and again, that was to ensure that we got input and made informed decisions related to the input from our stakeholders, both internally and externally, those business rules have now been finalized, so that challenge is no longer in existence for us. We also decided in October 2019 to make a transition with our project manager. This also resulted in greater efficiencies and accountability with respect to working with our vendor, as well as ensuring we had needed foundational project management procedures and processes to support the successful implementation of the project. Another challenge that we experienced was around the vendor having to develop new technical designs and configuration to meet the RFP requirements, as well as our unique business needs in Arizona to support some of our additional goals around access to care monitoring, as well as ensuring we had flexibilities in our state to address technology areas in our state that had limited or intermittent or even non-existent technological infrastructure to support implementation of EVV. Those issues were resolved in March of this year. The certification process, which Dan is going to go over in just a few moments, CMS changed the certification process for the system back in 2019 to an outcomes-based certification process. This resulted in some delays just trying to learn both from our IVNV vendor, as well as both Arizona and Hawaii needed to learn more in addition to our system vendor Sandata to better understand what the requirements were, We have instituted regular certification meetings with both our IBNV vendor and our EVV vendor to ensure that planning and development is contemplated for this outcomes-based measure certification, which includes making sure we are primed to provide and address all the key performance indicators, even as we plan for system deployment and program go live. As noted earlier, our most recent project delay has been in response or as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. Internally, Axis has had to redeploy some testing resources, which has extended the testing project phase of the project, which is now reflected in our new proposed timeline, which we'll review with you in a few moments. While we also wanted to create some flexibilities to allow providers additional time to comply with EVV after having a period of time to accommodate their business and service delivery practices to ensure risk mitigation to members as well as support members who have tested positive for the illness. We also have extensive measures in place to make sure we mitigate any further project delays beyond the schedule, the proposed schedule we'll be sharing with you today. That ensures we're actively identifying and mitigate any of those current risks. We have regular project status calls, multiple calls, in fact, both internal and vendor-led, to ensure that we're identifying those opportunities, and routine calls to review our RAID log. Next slide, please. Anticipating that we would have some project delays is allowed under the federal mandate. We requested a good faith effort extension from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services back in November 2019 and was granted that extension in December. They gave us an extension through the end of this calendar year for program go live through 12/31. So we have decided to exercise propose to you that we would exercise this allowance. Many of the activities on this timeline have already been started and some are near to completion. Our original project end date was 9/30 of this year, and we are requesting an extension to the end of calendar year 21, which incorporates a full year of activities around our certification requirements post the new proposed program go live date of 1/1/21. We have phases. We are in phases right now around testing, file structure, and connectivity, along with systems integration testing, which those are what very soon will be coming to an end. And we will be moving into the phase where we will exhibit our production deployment, as well as the third-party testing, which is the testing of those vendors that providers have preferred to utilize versus the state procured vendor. We will have our meeting with CMS around our operational review readiness for our certification in October, followed by an extensive training phase that will include various training methodologies for all audiences, including LMS training, webinar-based training. And we were originally planning for classroom-based training for some providers who may need additional support or more hands-on support. And we are now exploring a virtual classroom environment to support that as a result of the social distancing guidelines from the CDC. So our new program, Go Life, is planned for 1/1/21, followed by a short period of time where we allow providers to continue to bill for services while we do some soft edits to those claims where there may be missing or incomplete or inaccurate information that EVV would require for payment in the future to allow additional time for training and technical assistance for providers, followed by a time frame where we ultimately will not be able to pay claims unless those issues are rectified. I'm going to now defer to my colleague, Dan Lippert, to talk about the certification cycle, which largely happens post-program go live in the year of 2021. Next slide, please.
Dan, I think you're muted.
I think you're right. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my apologies. Still working on these video conferences, I guess. I'm going to take some of the milestones that were on the timeline and pull out the ones that are related to certification. CMS requires certification on any system that they provide funding for over a certain dollar amount. This would be one of those. So this is a CMS objective. Our goal is to have our system technology ready for deployment on 8/24/2020. That will include having the changes made to the existing systems for both Arizona and Hawaii. Then on that same date, we will submit the CMS intake form, essentially telling them, giving them notice that we are ready for them to start reviewing our system and the necessary paperwork to allow us to go live. On 10/15 or thereabouts, this is dependent on CMS's schedule. The CMS operational readiness review will occur. They will review what we have done. They will review testing results, those sort of things, to give us permission to go live. So the actual go live date with providers will be 12/31/2020. That is when providers can come in and start using the system. We will start with allowing some flexibility in this because there are new, this is new for our provider community. One of the things with certification with CMS, and to make sure that we receive enhanced federal funding moving forward for the maintenance and operational costs, is we have to show that the system is functional and operational for a minimum of 6 months. And we do that by key performance indicators, the objective-based certification. So what we do there is we go through with CMS and agree what the objectives of the system are, how to measure that, and provide them proof that those objectives have been met. They will review those. We will submit those around 4/15, and then we will have our CMS certification meeting sometime around July 16th, 2021. Again, that is dependent on CMS scheduling. But those are the goals as set forth for our certification. Next slide. Okay, at this point, I will turn it over to Jeff Teagan to discuss the financials.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is Jeff Teagan, Assistant Director for the Division of Business and Finance. With regards to the financing for this project, as it's been mentioned, this is a federal mandate, and because it is running through our Medicaid Management Information System, it is eligible for 90% federal match. So you can see the original project budget at a little over $2 million is going to be funded 90% by the federal government. The remaining 10% state match is split evenly between Arizona and Hawaii since we are partners in this project. The increase in cost of about $962,000, primarily due to some of the delays that Dara described and essentially having to extend the timeline. There is also included in that increase a customization specifically for the state of Hawaii, and since they are the only ones requesting that customization, they will pay 100% of the state match for that. So that's why under state fiscal year 21 there, you see Hawaii picking up a larger amount of the state match by about $35,000. That's due to a customization that they specifically requested. So our total project cost increase of $962,000, the federal government is going to pick up about $865,000. The impact of the state general fund is about $30,000. And with that, I will turn it back over to Dara for the summary.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, next slide, please. I'm sorry. As our final summary for you today, we wanted to just summarize our change requests in front of you today. is to extend our program end date from 9/30/2020 to 12/30/2021, which really allows us that extended period for certification, as well as any final payments and things that we need to make to close out the project. The changes in scope, my colleague Jeff Teagan alluded to, really have to do with an extension of various contracts for the timelines related to the challenges we described above to you around our IV&V vendor, both SendData, which is our EVV system vendor, for additional months of project management, and the resource plan changes relate to staff augmentation that has been extended to support the project. And the vendor contract extension is that it is truly the one scope change, which is something Hawaii specifically requested, which it will be fully funded from Hawaii, as Jeff alluded to or explained. And then finally, this equates to a change in program development costs from the $2.1 million to roughly $3 million. And with that, thank you. This concludes our presentation.
Okay, with that, we'll turn it over to any questions from the committee members. Okay, if there are no questions, I'll turn it back to Sudaba.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, ASSET is recommending that the change request be approved with the following conditions. Should development costs exceed the approved estimates by 10% or more, or should there be significant changes to the proposed technology, scope of work, or implementation schedule, the agency must amend the pitch to reflect the changes and submit to ADOA ASSET.
Okay, any questions on or comments on those conditions from the committee? All right, I will accept a motion with regards to the project.
This is Jeggy. I'll approve.
Thank you, Jeggy. Do we have a second?
This is Brian. I'll second.
Okay, thank you, Brian. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, that motion carries unanimously. We'll move on to next item on our agenda. Thank you, Dan, Jeff, and Dara. Okay, next item on our agenda is the Department of Environmental Quality. They're bringing forward the MyDEQ application with an update.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Damon Wellman, and I'm an engagement manager with the Department of Administration. I am joined online by members of the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, who will introduce themselves.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. This is Gary Heller. I'm the Chief Information Officer of ADEQ.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Sudhakar Radha. I'm the Deputy Chief Information Officer for ADEQ.
This is Steve Benton. I'm the Assistant Deputy Director for Business and Finance, ADEQ.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Poole. I'm the Business and Finance Policy Advisor.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, ADEQ seeks to change the scope of work in response to the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, ruling to include additional service in the scope of work, and the approval of a change to the cost allocation and the indirect cost methodology. The indirect cost methodology does not impact the project budget or schedule. But at this time, I will turn it over to the project team to present additional project information, propose amendment, and answer any questions that you may have.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is Sudhakar Rada again. We're here to seek your approval for the changes in the scope and the cost allocation. The scope change is driven by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency's rule change that was published recently in the second week of April. But it's been almost 9 months since we came before ITAC, so we thought we'd use this time to provide a general update on the project and the positive impact this initiative had on the agency's operations since we launched this initiative 5 years ago. We primarily launched this initiative because of the customer's demand for online services so that they can meet the environmental obligations. But we were keenly aware of the technology investment needs and the possibility that it could be a multi-year initiative. So we wanted to make sure the investments are driven by transformative results, and we came up with a service catalog approach. So we looked at all the services that the agency provides to the Arizona businesses, and we've cataloged those services. We have around 177 of those, and we have prioritized them based on the usage as well as the customer demand. And we started developing those services. And as we make progress every year, we came in front of ITAC to seek further approval for future investments. As you see on the slide, we have around 67 services that are online today. And we have another 7 services ready for deployment in June. They're currently being tested by the end users. Next slide, please. For our agency, permit issuance and the return to compliance timeframes are the key performance metrics. Tracking the positive impact of the initiative on these performance measures will inform whether to continue to make the investments in the future or not. As you can see on the slide, for the permits that we have brought online, we have seen a 99% reduction in the permit issuance time, as well actually as the return to compliance timeframes. We have around 26,000 facilities in Arizona that are permitted by ADEQ. Out of those, roughly 14,000 facilities are in MyDEQ already. So they are using online services versus paper. Next slide, please. Just want to continue actually to update on the progress. You can see we have roughly 4,858 companies that have registered with MyDEQ. In the current fiscal year alone, in the last 10 months, we have 25,000 transactions performed on the MyDEQ system. We've also collected $4 million electronic payments. We receive the payments for the permits available online. For the compliance activities, we don't receive any payments. So just for the permitting side alone, we received $4 million actually payments in MyDEQ. EPA, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, has a calculator. They use the calculator to measure the economic benefits to the individual states based on the online services they implement. Based on their forecast, Arizona actually seeing roughly $154 million positive economic impact on the state of Arizona. In addition to that, we reached a milestone in 2018. In 2018, we have more transactions performed online than on paper. Even though in terms of the services, we just implemented only 67 services of the 177, they are prioritized by usage, so they are the most heavily used services. Hence, we are back in 2018 itself, we have reached that critical mark. I believe in this financial year, we have not counted the transactions yet, but we forecast to reach around 70% of the services to be online. In addition to that, a lot of our staff members that used to do data entry activities, they've been able to move on to the more value-added actually activities such as environmental compliance monitoring and planning. We are able to put more boots on the ground with the inspections. In addition to that, with the onset of the pandemic, while we didn't plan for it, since we have all these services online, the impact of our agency has been mitigated. I wouldn't say mitigated, but it's been largely minimized because a large portion of our services are coming online. Next slide, please. When we started this initiative, MyDEQ initiative, 5 years ago, Arizona is one of actually the few states that had everything on paper. A lot of other states had online services, though most of them have essentially the paper forms hung on their websites as PDFs. But they still had actually the applications, permit applications available online that people actually could fill and submit. We consciously chose to take a different approach. We wanted to make sure that customers are able to submit an application, and we're also able to process it actually online. And we wanted to compress the time frame. We wanted to make sure that the permits are issued as fast as we can, considering all the environmental rules and regulations in the perspective. In the last 5 years, we have covered a lot of this ground. With the 67 services online, with another actually 7 in the development, we are one of the leading states in the country that is leveraging technology to transform the environmental protection. We also brought radical simplicity to our customers and staff. Unlike other states that have just the PDFs online, we have a TurboTax-like application process. It makes the whole environmental regulations transparent. So it's a Q&A based design, which helps the customers to just provide the right information and mitigates the errors that we typically foresee. Next slide, please. Again, in the last 5 years, we've been recognized by different groups for what we have done on the MyDEQ. In addition to all these recognitions, I won't go through them. You can see them yourself. But we've also hosted EPA, the federal EPA, states and tribes on a number of tours. Every year, at least, we have had one tour so far. States, tribes, either facilitated by EPA or facilitated by Environmental Council of States, they visited us, they had a tour, they wanted to understand how we have actually reached this stage. We've been helping other states with their own actually plans for leveraging technology as well. Next slide, please. Coming to the current initiative, we call it MyDEQ FY19. We came before ITAC in July or September of 2019. We had a late start for this project in March 2019. As of today, we have the scope was to develop 22 services, and we have delivered 7 of them already, and 9 additional services are nearing completion. We have spent $1.8 million as of May 5th. Again, that was the number as of May 5th. When we got the update yesterday from our AFIS system, we're roughly around $2.3 million spent, and we have invoices that still need to be paid. So we're on track as well on the funding side. We have seen two impacts to the project. One is the EPA rule change, and the second is we have change the indirect methodology that we had in the agency. We'll go through those two in the next couple of slides. Next slide, please. So EPA has recently published a rule for navigable water protection. It changed the definition of the waters of the U.S. Most of our permits are dependent on the ruling for the waters of the U.S. We require permits in case the facilities are discharging anything into those waters. Since the rules have been changed, that impacts some of the services that are some of the permits that we have in scope. They may not have as much need as we initially forecasted before the rule change. So what we propose to do is remove six of those services that are impacted by this rule change and replace them with another six that are in the service catalog. So we originally proposed to implement 22 services. We still plan to implement 22 services by the end of June. We just would like to seek your approval to replace the previous six with the next prioritized six services. Next slide, please. Every state environmental agency is required to reach annual agreements with the federal EPA over the indirect methodologies, the indirect cost methodologies. For the fiscal year 20, ADEQ reached an agreement with EPA for the indirect charging up to 32.49%. But that was at the agency level, but we have applied only 10% indirect rate up until January, and then we've increased that to 32.49%. This changed our operational expenses that we originally proposed when we had the pitch. So it was 200,000 before. Now that number actually jumped approximately up to 600,000. Next slide, please. So as a summary, we still plan to deliver 22 online services. We're not asking for additional budget. We still plan to deliver within the $3.2 million that we originally forecasted. And we still plan to deliver by June 30th. With that, that's all I have to present. If there is any questions, I'll be able to answer them. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Sudhakar. Okay, we'll turn over to the committee for any questions with regards to the project.
Mr. Chair, if I may ask a question.
Yep.
It's Rebecca. So my first question is, could you maybe explain a little bit more for the agency? Can you explain a little bit more of the indirect cost calculation and what that funding, where it's going and what it is funding and for this project?
The indirect cost methodology was up until the last fiscal year was purely based on the personal cost. And it was, and in this fiscal year, we've moved away from that approach to a more equitable approach. So we have projects within our agencies that do not just leverage the personnel, but also includes contractors, procurement, and activities like that. Up until last year, projects such as MyDEQ were not charged any indirect methodology, even though we have been using the agency's resources for procurement, for contracting, for licensing, and things like that. So the agency wanted to be more equitable, actually, in the way it charges the indirect methodology, so they adopted this new methodology in this year. The funds that we accrue with this approach pays for actually those costs that are provided for the agency's operation. So take, for example, like IT, where we provide the infrastructure for whether it is laptops, desktops, whether it is software, all of that actually is paid through these indirect cost methodologies. Similarly, there are actually other groups within the agency, both within the business and finance and communications. We all actually are paid through these indirect charges.
Okay, thank you, Rebecca, again. That helps me understand a little bit more about the indirect cost. My second question, and maybe this is more of a question for JR or Chuck or the oversight group, is we haven't really seen indirect costs. Two questions, really. We haven't really seen indirect costs as a project, as in a county line in pitches. So I wanted to get your perspective on that. And then 32%, is there an industry standard for indirect costs? And the director's office, the procurement, the infrastructure the agencies have in charging their project appropriations?
So, Mr. Chairman, would you like me to?
Yeah, go ahead. That?
This is Chuck. So, for the record, this is Chuck Brown. Mr. Chairman, Rebecca, thank you for the question. As far as the standard, I would say within the oversight process, right, it's not usual to see indirect costs built in within these project layers, specifically within APF-funded project. There are unique circumstances we run into outside of the 90% of projects that follow the same kind of path line. So in that scenario of the 10% where we have to meet, take in unique requests or circumstances, the normal process is to be transparent, work with the agency, identify that information, and then along the approval path for the project, expose that so that everybody's informed and aware. So when oversight became aware of this change, that's the process that was followed in this unique circumstance was. The budget office within the governor's office was informed. The agency was brought in to talk to the oversight and other members of ADOA as well as OSPB to get a full disclosure of what was happening. And then once we had a solid idea of how this had changed, it was determined to bring it to the committee for full disclosure and transparency. As far as a industry standard on the second part of your question, there's not a specific one that we could point our fingers at and say that we know this is a normal. Based on experience from both members of the oversight team and others, I would say, right, it's not unusual to look at the 10% they had mentioned before for indirect costs related to projects within an agency budget. However, I couldn't say that the 30-some percent is within a normal standard at this point. So let me know if I didn't answer any of that question fully, please.
And I think that answers my question. Maybe more something to explore for the committee or for us as a whole, and this might be that 10%, like you said, that I've never really seen indirect cost charge to a project. And if the committee is charged with looking at mitigating risk, the reasonableness of projects, I don't know if this is something we might want to pursue or if this is just that 10% and assets doing a great job looking at all the projects, and sometimes these anomalies come up. So I just wanted to ask the question and put it out there for maybe just a comment. 32% on indirect costs seems a little high for charging projects, but having not seen this, I just wanted to get more perspective. So thank you.
You're welcome.
I'll open up to the committee members for any further questions or comments on that item or anything else.
Chairman, this is Dave Byers. Given that they're still doing 22 services and the budget's the same and the date's the same, why is it we have to approve anything? We're not in the business of approving their indirect or direct charges. Other agencies do have indirect charge systems. We don't usually get into that. So why is this here? I can see a GLBC or the governor's office being interested in the methodology they're using to do their indirect costs, but ITECs never got into that, how agencies charge their indirect costs to the federal government and so on. So what are we approving here with there's no change in scope or completion date or budget?
Chuck, can you speak to that, why you brought it back?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mr. Byers, no, thank you for the question. So what's before you today is within the normal course of a project, if a substantial scope change takes place, which in this case is a substantial shift in the intended licenses and in the intended effect of the project, we would bring it before the committee, even though in total the same permit or the number of permits are similar. It's a major shift or a substantial shift in the intended license that were infected. So for transparency purposes, that's the purpose of the scope change of this change request. In normal circumstances, once a budget exceeds the 10% overrun of the overall budget, we would then execute a change request. In this scenario, again, for the purposes of transparency and making sure all decision makers are involved in understanding where the budget's being sent, part of the responsibility of ITAC is that risk mitigation, is understanding what money's being spent on what. This is a substantial change within the internal intended expenditure at the time of approval. So we felt it was important that the committee be informed, explained what has taken place. I think as Rebecca alluded to, there's going to be some further discussion on future processes to ensure we capture these things before it comes to the committee. But again, we're asking for a scope change request to be approved, the committee to be informed of the substantial dollar shift in the budget, not over budget, but just within the intended budget. And that's it. As far as going forward on indirect costs, again, that'll be a continued discussion between oversight, the governor's office, and GLBC.
Well, the reason I ask is I suspect every large state agency has an indirect cost methodology that they use with pulling down federal funds. And I just want to be clear if we're saying to the agencies, if they change that methodology, does it have to come to ITAC if that methodology impacts a project? Because all the years I've been on ITAC, I've never seen this come up. And I would be surprised that no agency on all that, all those decades, I just suspect there have been changes to their indirect methodologies.
Yep, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Byers, to respond again on behalf of oversight, I don't think we see this on a regular occurrence, right? It's
my
not normal
it,
that we see that in a budget.
My guess it's in the budget. For example, the reason the state charges itself rent on buildings is so that rent can be rolled into the indirect charges to pull down federal money. So when you have project teams in state buildings, my guess is that's part of the, you know, operating costs, or it's built in somewhere. And so we just may never have had it pulled out like this before, but my guess is indirect costs have been in lots of projects over the years.
Okay.
I mean, even data center charges, right? Those are charged back to projects and so on. So I don't want to belabor the point, but I just want the agencies to be clear. If we're, you know, if we're making a change in our role, I just want people to understand what that is.
Yeah. Well, I guess, Dave, I agree with you. I don't think that having a cost allocation show up in a project is new. You know, at least, and this is the first one that I recall coming to ITAC for the years that I've been a part of the committee as well.
Yeah.
And the only thing that was remarkable to me was the change in amount, right? Going from the from 10 to 30, and I think like has been, you know, noted, we didn't have a lot of other ones to look at to reference to say, is this reasonable or is this out of the ordinary? So I think we can kind of take note of this. And I think just for clarity, Chuck, the other reason this was brought forward was because while there's still 22 services, which services shifted, correct?
Correct. Yeah. Or sorry, Mr. Chairman, members of committee, that's correct. They're part of this change request. Is the scope
yeah
change
okay
yeah that's fair
All right. Any other questions from the committee? All right, Damon, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the official amendment, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, will read, ADQ would like to change the MyDEQ FY19 project scope to address the Environmental Protection Agency electronic reporting rule for National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System reports. This EPA rule requires regulated entities to submit these reports electronically starting December 21st, 2020. The rule also requires states to share the corresponding permits, compliance monitoring, violation determination, and enforcement action data electronically with the EPA. The revised scope will still deliver 22 online services instead of 20 in the original scope. The proposed completion date for the project is still 6/30/2020, and it would deliver within the original development budget. ACET is recommending that the amendment be approved with the following conditions. Should the final costs exceed the estimated cost by 10% or more, or should there be significant changes to the proposed technology scope of work or implementation schedule, the agency must amend the pitch to reflect the changes and submit back to ADOA ACET for review and approval prior to further expenditure of funds.
Okay, thank you, Damon. Any questions or comments from the committee on those conditions? All right. With that, I'll take a motion with regard to the project.
Mr. Chair, this is Eddie. I move to approve with the conditions.
Thank you, Eddie. Do we have a second?
Mr. Chairman, this is Tim. I'll make the second.
Thank you, Tim. Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, motion carries unanimously. Thank you, Shudhakar, and the environmental quality team. Okay, I'm going to do just a quick time check. We've got 10 minutes planned in our agenda, and one voting item and two informational items yet to cover. So I don't want to unnecessarily rush, but I do want to be attentive to the time. Next item coming forward is from the Department of Health Services with their licensing system implementation.
Yes. Hi, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Haley Greenberg. I'm an engagement manager with the Department of Administration. I am joined here today by members of the Department of Health Services who will introduce themselves now, followed by a brief overview of the project.
Hello, everybody. This is Colby Bauer. I'm an assistant director with the Arizona Department of Health Services. I oversee the licensing division.
Hi, this is Luke Evans, Information Technology Project Management Office Manager.
And hi, this is Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This is Paula Mattingly, Assistant Director and Chief Information Officer.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, on September 18th, 2019, the Medical Marijuana Licensing Implementation Project Investment Justification was approved with standard conditions by ITAC Committee. The project seeks to implement a medical marijuana system to replace the current licensing system that will leverage newer technology and replace all paper and printing processes associated with the current system, including a digital card solution. ADHS seeks a change request to expand the use of the existing system integration team, SHI, to leverage the successful December 2019 and upcoming May and June releases of the medical marijuana system components and respond to the unforeseen COVID-19 impediments to agency staff, agency priorities, medical marijuana dispensary owners, and the general public. This change includes a 12-month maintenance and operation plan aiming to completely transition full-time ADHS staff to maintain their application. At this time, I will turn it over to the project team to present any additional information regarding the proposed amendment and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Haley. Mr. Chairman and the committee, I will try to get through this as quick as we can to leave as much time for questions as possible. This is really just a change request. As Haley noted, we were back in September with you earlier where, if you'll recall, the state passed a law that mandated The Arizona Department of Health start delivering all of its marijuana licenses electronically by December 1. And we were grateful that the committee greenlit this project back in September. We're happy to report that the department and the IT integration team met that deadline. We were able to issue electronic cards starting in December 1st. And minus just a small hiccup with an image issue that was fixed, we couldn't be more happy. We've received so much feedback from patients and cardholders and dispensaries that the project really was an overwhelming success. We are now processing those marijuana cards, and patients are receiving them in the same day, which is something that was, you know, before taking 5 to 7 days when you factor in the mail time and everything else. And we've achieved those savings in terms of our printing of those cards. So what we've got today for you there, I think I just moved myself to the third slide, sorry. So just high level, Haley really summed it up best, is what we were looking at is in the initial pitch, we hoped to really transition the M&O of this project to FTEs within DHS. However, COVID-19 hit. And so those staff that we had earmarked to really work on the M&O and to get them fully transitioned and up to speed with this new product have had their time and efforts moved over to the COVID-19 response. And so we are we're asking the committee to approve us using the existing integrator, SHI, I always want to say SHI, to come on and provide that 12 months of M&O while we continue to roll this out through the entire marijuana program. So today was another milestone. You'll see there on the third slide, we actually went live with another feature. And by all accounts, it's working great. That allows our dispensaries to apply electronically. And then that first week in June, we're really looking to roll out full integration with the dispensaries and the patient portal. So the patients will be able to much easier log into an account and see where their card is, see how much product they purchased over the last 2.5 weeks, that type of thing. So that is, that's sort of it in a nutshell. Haley, if we can go to slide number 5 or whoever's working that, you can kind of see the overall financials, and really that increased cost is bore here in year 1. But as we bring on our FTEs, we're anticipating lower costs build out year 3 through 5 with this change. Just as a reminder as well to the committee, this project is being funded by the Medical Marijuana Fund, which is a fund that consists of cardholders and dispensary fees that is non-appropriated and voter-protected. So the legislature does not have the authority to appropriate these dollars, and the legislature cannot sweep these dollars. And it's been much publicized in the media how much money is actually in that account. I don't have a recent update for you, but I did want to make sure the committee understands these are not general fund tax dollars. These are dollars that have been paid for by patients and dispensaries, and this project is really all about improving their user experience with the department. Let me see. I think I pretty much covered it all. Again, in the interest of time, we can move directly to question and answers.
All right. Thank you, Colby. So over to the committee. Any questions with regard to the project and the explanation of the change in financials?
Mr. Chairman, Dave Byers again. I don't want to take time, but when this project came up in September, I voted no, because I was doing some mental math on the cost per license, which my mental math was wrong. I realized that after the meeting, I had moved the decimal point two places over. So nice going, Department of Health Services. I followed this project. You got it done in an extraordinary amount of time, and I'm sorry I voted no back in September.
Hey, we were there with you moving the decimal point in the wrong spot.
I guess you were all too polite to correct my math in the meeting.
That's not my strong.
So I'll be happy to vote when I make a motion when the time is right, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thanks, Dave. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Okay, Haley, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. ACID is recommending that the pitch be, the change request be approved with the following standard condition. Should expenses exceed the estimated cost by 10% or more, or should there be a significant change to the proposed technology, scope of work, or implementation schedule, the agency must amend the pitch to reflect the changes and submit it to ADOA ACID for review and approval by ITAC prior to further expenditure of funds.
Okay. Any comments or questions from the committee on the conditions? With none, I'll take a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval with the conditions. This is Dave.
Thank you, David. Do I have a second?
Mike Dobb, I'll second.
Thank you, Mike. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 And any opposed? Okay, thank you. Motion carries with unanimous approval. Again, congratulations to the health services team on the implementation, and thank you for all the efforts of the organization protecting the state during the COVID crisis.
Thank you.
Okay, the last two items we have on our agenda are informational only. These are not voting items. First up is the Department of Corrections with their update on the adult inmate management system replacement.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Haley Greenberg. I am an engagement manager with the Department of Administration. I am joined here today by members of the Department of Corrections who will introduce themselves now and give you a closeout report on the inmate management system.
Yes, so hello, Mr. Chairman, as well as members of the committee. This is Holly Green. I am the Deputy CIO, Chief Information Officer for ADCRR. May I proceed, Haley?
Yes, sorry, I didn't realize I muted myself. Yes, 100%.
Yes, you're all good. So again, this is just an informational status update regarding the Arizona Department of Corrections Rehabilitation and Reentry ACES system, the Arizona Correctional Information System, formerly known as AIMS-2. So our project trajectory for statewide go-live, we have achieved maintenance and operations. So that was a big plus for us. Update since April. So again, intense work was actually performed to construct the functional gap analysis in support of the movement to M&O. We did successfully achieve that. ADCRR and B&B, our vendor, we did reach an agreement with the signed contract amendment 9. That was signed as of April 30th, 2020. There was no deviation from ITAC or JLBC approved budget. So we're still within those parameters. Now with the M&O phase, with respect to the contract itself and Amendment 9, again, that was signed by both ADCRR and B&B on April 30th, 2020. Maintenance and operations phase contains the following agreed upon items as noted, which is 10,000 M&O hours supported by B&B annually. We also have 10,000 hours of additional one-time remediation hours to support improvements from the end user experience as well as our parking lot items and any other enhancements requests that may come through. We also agreed mutually the release of disputes through and including up to April 30th, 2020. So relationships have improved. We're doing great on that front. And then finally, for the first 30 days of M&O, what we're trying to tackle, at least at this particular point, is for ITAC and PIDGE administration, we did submit our final PIDGE status report to support the closure of this particular project endeavor. And then for maintenance and operations commencement deliverables, we are in the process of identifying and approving the first group of remediation items. That list was constructed and sent over for review by B&B, and they will be attaching their estimated hours of time for each of those items. And then the finalization of service level agreements, those have been agreed upon as well and are in process of receiving our senior leadership approval. And then the solidification of the incident management process that is currently underway. All of those deliverables are due by May 25th of this year. So with that, that's really all I have. Thank you so much for your time today.
Okay. With that, I will open it up to the committee if you have any questions.
Mr. Chair, if I may ask, or
yes.
Say a few things. it's Rebecca. First of all, congratulations, ADCRR, closing out the project. I know it was not an easy last year to get it complete, so it's a milestone that should be celebrated. So congratulations. And with that, I did if this is the closeout and the last update, and I'm sure you're probably thrilled to not be coming back to the committee again, I do have some I'll just throw this out there for the committee, is some concerns on that parking lot. And the last status update I remember seeing that there were customers, your COs, maybe were still doing workarounds and some manual processes. And I'll say this because I don't have a vote on this committee, but I would be wondering if the committee would be open to having, if ADCRR would be open to coming back in maybe a year with the lessons learned and a status on just how successful that the first year went, and where you what you're able to complete with the vendor, and your plans on moving forward, because I think that would be good information for us to know and see and digest as a year from now. So I will open that, or I would throw that out there, knowing that you guys might just all decide that Rebecca's ideas are not enough. So.
So I'll open that to the committee for discussion.
All right. Everyone's just tired.
That's a possibility.
So Rebecca, I'll tell you, my own opinion is, yeah, I'm certainly interested in a project of this size and scope, gets across the finish line. We know that there were some struggles along the way. I'll say as part of the organization, and especially not only with ITAC, but also DOA and our role, I definitely am interested in lessons learned and seeing the long-term success of projects. So I personally have an interest in hearing those updates. But I will defer to the committee as to whether you would like to have an informational update come through this forum again.
Hi, this is Gil Arantia. I totally agree with you. I think anytime we can learn something, and there's many things that we strive to do, and when we can overcome some of those hurdles, it's great to hear those stories. So I would be in favor of that.
Okay. Anyone else?
So this is David. I think it's a great idea. And Haley, is the sentencing module working? That was one of the biggest risks, and I think at the end it was one of the last things to get done, and very complicated. So is that module working okay?
This is Holly Green, and yes, it is. We do have some enhancements that we do need to implement, but outside of that, it is. And it's actually one of the better functions and surprised our time comp group as well. I'm proud to say that.
Terrific.
Mr. Chair and Haley, I think that's really good to hear. I know that sentencing will be, there is always discussions at the legislature on changing that. And so, in that, if you were to come back, we'd probably, and I'm sure Mr. Byers would be also interested in knowing what, how easy you are able to implement anything should changes be made, and your whole process in getting here. So.
Yeah, I think we can certainly get that in an informational update. It will be a major, depending upon how complex a change is to sentencing, whether that change in and of itself would drive a page that would come to this level. It would be great to hear the answer be no. okay, so if ADCRR is open, then I think we would log the request to the committee that you plan to come back in about a year. So we'll say that's flexible, May or June, and provide a report on what's been achieved, successes, any ongoing challenges, and the roadmap forward.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much, Holly. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Last item is Department of Child Safety. Normally. They haven't done a lot of, it's been a while since we've heard from them, but we've got, I think, folks from DCS here today. They will be providing an informational update on where we are with the Guardian project.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Once again, my name is Damon Wellman, an engagement manager with the Department of Administration, and I'm joined online by members of the Department of Child Safety, who will please introduce themselves.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Linda Roberts. I am the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Child Safety and the program sponsor for Guardian. And I am joined by James Dean.
All right. Great. Thank you. As requested by ITAC, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, DCS is providing an informational-only update to the overall status of their child's replacement project, better known as Guardian. Take it away.
So, Lynn, I saw a note from James that his microphone is not working, so.
Gotcha.
Okay. I can tell you, Mike Faust, our director, is also in attendance. So, thank you very much. So, is there a presentation? Perfect. Thank you so much. So next slide, please. So we are so happy to let you know what some of the changes and progress are for our program. I can tell you, so while this is 2 weeks late, or 2 weeks later than when our ITAC presentation went out, I am excited to tell you we are in the middle of end-to-end testing. We have started UAT testing. We have started and are in progress of performance testing. We are in progress of security testing. We are in iteration 17 build for version 1.1, and for iteration 18, we are finishing solution modeling and design. So while that's a lot and lots of different things going on, I wanted to tell you what the current focus of this program is. But I will give you an update of what our, where we are, right now. So of all of the business requirements have been obviously solution modeled and designed, and I can tell you all of them. So while this particular slide here shows you where they are in the demo, whether they've been demo accepted, I can tell you they've all been demoed accepted, and we have gone through all of the P1s of our priority one requirements are done with end-to-end testing. We're in the middle of priority two and three of end-to-end testing. And we started UAT testing last week. We finished intake and eligibility module, and we are in assessment and case management for this week. Also, we started last week our security testing. So this is where we hire a third party to come in and do some penetration testing. So if you remember kind of our architecture and our program, we have lots of hosted type solutions, whether they're it's Dynamics, that's Dynamics 365. There's a lot of Azure services, whether it's Logic Apps, which provides access to data. We have OnBase, which is a hosted solution. We use Azure AD, Azure Active Directory, through federated services, in which we apply single sign-on for all of those components and services to work together. So as you can imagine, with all of those different pieces and architecture, having that penetration testing is super important for us. So we have two different pieces of that security testing going on. We have the InfoSec within the Azure pieces itself. That is part of our Microsoft delivery from that program. And then we have the penetration, like I said, that we get a third party organization to come in and do for us. So I do want to talk a little bit about, and you'll see the last bullet point where our program go live shifted from July 6th to August 3rd. So while we were in the middle of our end-to-end testing, we had realized about probably, like, we had some of the conditions in end-to-end testing fail, and we realized that we had implemented a previous version of our security roles. So this is around the user roles and what authority they have. So for instance, if I'm a DCS specialist, I should be able to execute this in my case plan and not be able or approve some certain things, not approve some things. So it's around that user access. We had realized that we had implemented in the version of the coding that we had done, that we had implemented a previous version. So not all of the roles were impacted, just some of the roles were impacted. So we went with that in order to kind of reset and retest and regress test all of those different conditions. We thought it best, instead of rushing that, since security and access management is super important, we wanted to be able to delay and push that go live date out a month. It's also kind of a blessing in disguise, because one of our requirements is that we actually train in person. So that would have meant our in-person training would have started May 11th, a week and a half ago, when the restrictions around social distancing weren't quite lifted yet, and that would have put a real strain on our resources trying to find rooms available where we can social distance, getting people engaged, getting ASU to go out. So this was, I don't want to say a blessing in disguise, so anytime you have a wrong security matrix implemented, that's not always best, but to be able to push out the program a month and give our state some recovery time around the social distancing was actually made our implementation much better for that. So in essence, that pushed our UAT to start last week, which was May 11th, and it also pushes our in-person training to start on June 8th. That is after the social distancing. It's after our state has been lifted for that, and also we as an agency, are kind of slowly returning back and so forth. So we're managing some risks and keeping watch over that, but we fully intend to start our end user training on June 8th. Can you go to the next slide, please? Thank you. So next slide, I kind of talked through that a little bit. Our version one requirements have been developed. Next slide, please. Thanks. And this is our iteration burn down. So like I said, we are well, 2 weeks later after we submitted this, we are full into all the different testing pieces. Can you advance one more slide, please? Thank you. So as you can see here, kind of a slice through our program and move that closer to the June or into the middle of May, we are nearing the end of our end-to-end testing. So we started out with all of our P1s have been end-to-end tested. We are now at the end of our end-to-end for priority 2 and 3 requirements. We are starting UAT this week, or we're in the middle of that, for case management and assessment. We are performance testing. So that is not only performance testing within Dynamics itself, but really that end-to-end performance testing when it comes to making sure that our retrieve and our services within all of the Azure components, whether it's Logic Apps, app management function, all of those things that really access the data are intact. And then our security testing, like I said, has started as well. Next slide, please. So for intake and assessment, these are actually our hotline or intake piece is actually through UAT. There were no priority one bugs found. That has gone through UAT. And like I said, that's going to be one of the first pieces that are trained. And then we'll have a follow up training closer to the go live. Next slide, please. Legal and case management. These requirements are in UAT, testing now. Next slide, please. Eligibility and permanency. So all of our requirements, eligibility and permanency are fully in test. So they are in the end-to-end testing now, and we start, eligibility finished UAT last week. They are permanency is, I believe, coming up in UAT in another week. And next slide, please. Financials and providers. So this is another one that I believe financials and providers are closer to the end of our UAT cycle. Next slide, please. And data. So if you remember, members of the committee, these were the ones that I said, you know, please, if you're going to ask me questions about the health of my project, to really kind of be focused on the data side. So with this, our ODS, so we kind of look at this in our operational data store, and really being able to lock that and kind of time those migration efforts. So we have migrated several million records so far, and it's a big rinse and repeat process. So we are timing and getting the timing down of all of these migration activities where we can do full data runs and test what that will be and do incremental runs starting in July almost every day, every couple of days until we get to that cutover. So really the important piece that we're really focused on now, obviously, is in the end-to-end and all of the testing pieces, getting ready for training, but getting these cutover tasks really down to the hour and minute, figuring out how much it will be to migrate all of this data, and just, you know, be mindful because not everything is mapped one-to-one when you have a mainframe system that's based on narrative and you're going to kind of a field focused quality system. Not everything maps one to one. So really getting that quality aspect through that data cleansing activity and figuring out really the timing of moving all of those data elements over. So from our interfaces perspective, our interface development for Novatex is still there. We have one issue with one of our drug testing that we will have to make a determination whether we actually go live with that particular interface. But everything else is seeming to move forward with that. Getting that business validation tasks over the next 6 weeks in our data migration will be truly key. So we have, it's not just, you know, from a, if you kind of look at it this way, if you think of from a design development on the data side, it works a little bit differently. So that business validation kind of validates the design. Now I can push more objects and more, more data through that. So that's really that iterative approach. And we continue to test the design of the ETL packages or those transform packages as we push that data through. We have steady progress on our reports, you know, the reports that are required for go live, more importantly, those requirements are those reports required for the Fed reporting in September and October. So that is the big progress to date. Can you advance? I don't remember the next slides. I'm sorry. Is there another? Oh, those are the common requirements. You can move past that one. Those are the ones that kind of go through the rest of them. So this is the testing. So 2 weeks ago we had, we had some things to overcome. This was, obviously the security roles not matching. We had, you know, we had shifted our go live date. We had, we made a choice to kind of put the business process testing on the back burner if we could determine that all of our end-to-end testing and so forth could go forward. And UAT, we also moved that completely remote instead of bringing people in. So we conduct it through Teams meetings, which is similar to Google Meet. And it actually has been way better than I thought it would be. So I was pleasantly surprised at how well people could execute UAT remotely. So anyway, that's about the end of our update. That's the least amount I've ever talked during one of these things. So I just want to throw that one out there.
Thanks, Linda. Hey, listen, I had a question. The one thing that popped out or stuck out for me was, you know, you highlighted again, data is like the big thing that is probably the least sexy part of the solution, but critical to its overall success. In terms of the business validations, have the business validations, it wasn't clear to me, are those already starting in that the business is, you know, already engaging with some of the data migrations and providing you feedback on that, or is that yet to come?
So it's yet to come. So I'll say that I'm doing this in phases. So the first piece of the data validation is first. So we have different landing spots for our data. So the first one is coming into our ODS, and our ODS is our operational data store. And the first part of that is just making sure that the packages are working. So if I had 10 records come through, I have 10 records on this side. So the first piece of that validation is just making sure I have those packages working. That part of that iteration is what's in progress now. And that's more on the technical side.
Okay.
As that's landed, now we'll start to engage our business SMEs. So it's consumable. So right now, just validating, I had 10 packages here and I had 10 packages, you know, did the data come out on that side? That's more of a technical, kind of rinse and repeat. Pete, that's in progress now. The next step is to really look at what is inside those records to make sure that
right.
So that will be a mix of technical and business people.
Okay. Yeah. No, cause that's where I perceive where your risk, when there's risk, that's where it's going to show up, right? Is when the business people start to work with the data, you got 10 records across. Did they show up in the fields as expected? Are the calculations, is the meaning there for them? You know, those types of things. And you won't get that until you get your business folks validating that component of it.
That's correct. So if you kind of look at that first bullet point in the testing slide over upcoming objectives, so where we're at right now is that Child's to ODS to CE staging. And so then when it comes to the CRM testing and data replication testing, those are the pieces that are really on the, that's where that business validation kind of comes in. So while this is the testing side, like how it's tested, those different pieces, whether it's Child's to ODS to CE staging to CE, like it goes through all of these different components in order for that validation to happen. So the business kind of happens on, the business validation happens on that back, on the back end.
Okay.
Or the further end.
That's okay. Thanks for clarifying that. Yeah. Any other questions from the committee for Linda on this? All right, Linda, congratulations on the progress, good to see that COVID didn't have a bigger impact. Sounds like you had the delay because of the security roles, but you might have encountered it because you couldn't get the people together to train them. So sort of a net neutral maybe, and not a huge impact with only a 1 month delay. So.
Yeah, so we're really, we're really proud of that. And now it's just, crazy. This is crunch time. So,
yeah.
We're certainly excited. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Linda. That concludes our content for today. Our next scheduled meeting is, June 17th. But as is traditional, our June meeting may shift a bit depending upon the timing of JLBC. So I understand the JLBC is looking at the last couple weeks in June. So as that congeals, we will adjust our date if necessary to ensure that we can review projects that need to hit that meeting. So with that, that's all we've got. Thanks, everybody, and appreciate everyone's participation and making a fully virtual ITAC pretty successful. So thank you all and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.